I would go with the questions concerning ETA. I would go to people in Spain. They know much more.
Yes, because there's a secret soldier, very interesting to study. It's called Jean-Pierre Chérid. He was a member of the OAS, and he's in the Montejurra attacks in the 70s. He's seen in pictures like Stefano Delle Chiaie and some others. And then he was killed in the 80s because he was doing some work for the Spanish state. And his widow, she asked for the Spanish state for money because she considered that her husband had died for doing a
State
work,
work.
state work. So it's very shocking. That's linked to the GAL. I don't know if you've heard about it. It was
Got it.
Grupos Antiterroristas de Liberación. It's
No, I don't know.
Liberation Antiterrorist Group. If you read your book, what comes to mind is this must be something related, but I know that there must be some further studies and investigation on all this, because I think your book may change some views about and put some context in all this violence.
I mean, that
So,
is really one of the main interests of my book. I want to open a new way of looking at terrorism in the sense that we have at sometimes terrorism which is manipulated by state institutions, and that we have in some cases a deliberate idea to spread fear. If you have the idea to spread fear in a society, that can be very, very useful to manipulate the society. And today, the topic of terrorism is very big. It's big news all the time. And it is very rare that we can go into the details of the terrorist attacks because it's very difficult to find out who was behind it because a terrorist bomb basically destroys most of everything. And you just see people suffering and it's very hard to find what happened. And then, if the state is behind it, then it is even more difficult to find out because it's the state who carries out the investigation what happened. And the state, as we saw in Italy, cannot accuse itself. It cannot be that, police officers of the state investigate a terrorist attack. And then, they might be honest people, and at the end they find out, oh, Jesus Christ, that's people employed by the state who carried out the attack. They cannot say that. They will lose their job right away. So the state cannot accuse itself, but researchers, historians, journalists, people who are interested in peaceful coexistence, they must research these questions more and more.
and do you know what happened in 1919 in Spain when Andreotti talked about the existence of Gladio in Italy? There was a huge scandal in Europe. You have mentioned that here in the parliament, some parliamentary asked for information to the Spanish president, but it seems like nobody knew about the existence of Gladio even when we entered in NATO in 1982. So how is this possible? Nobody knows anything. They are lying. What's happening?
When the secret army was discovered in Italy, that was a problematic thing, not only for people in Spain, but also for people in France and in Germany. It was very embarrassing because normally you don't have a secret army in a democracy. That is the whole idea of a democracy. You have an army, but everybody knows who is in that army and where the weapons are, and it's public. It's not something that nobody knows who's in the army and what they do. It's for a democracy, a very, very strange thing to have a secret army. The French, for instance, President Mitterrand in 1990 said, we don't have a secret army. And then the Italian Prime Minister, Giulio Andreotti, said, oh, let me check. In this last meeting of the Allied Clandestine Committee, that is that NATO group in which the secret armies met, the French were also there, not only the Italians. So you really have the Italians going down, taking a lot of criticism, and they said, well, the French did it as well. Don't attack us. And then the European Parliament said, we need a very thorough investigation into these secret armies, into the question of terrorism in Europe, into who paid this. And they protested towards NATO and said, how could you do this? These were parliamentarians of the European Parliament. And in Spain, you had a parliamentarian who was called Antonio Romero. I think he was from a left party. And he asked Defense Minister Serra, he asked him, what's actually going on? What's happening in Spain? We also have this secret army. Can you tell us more about it? And then Defense Minister Serra said, well, I asked the military secret service, the CESID, and there the director general was Alonso Manglano, and he just refused to comment. You know, he should have gone in front of parliament and answered the questions, but he didn't. So as you say, it ends up with nobody knows anything, nothing happened anyway, and forget about it as quickly as you can. I mean, that is really what happened in many countries. In Germany, we have this situation that the SPD, which is the central left party, said, we want a very, very thorough investigation of this. This is like the Ku Klux Klan. That is a quote. That's what they said. This is an illegal right-wing network engaged in criminal activities. We want to know what happened. And then people from the government, CDU, the chancellor was Helmut Kohl at the time, they informed the other party that during their time in office, during their time when the SPD had ruled Germany in the 70s, they had also covered the secret. And if they now wanted to talk about it, then the other political party is going to say what their responsibility was. So everybody was scared to talk about it because everybody was involved.
Let's talk about today. Does Gladio still exist?
I think what is important to understand that manipulated terrorism still exists. We still probably have attacks of terrorism, which we don't understand. We get a story and we believe the story, but you know, when we look at history, we find that many acts of terrorism need to be looked at in much more detail. And it can be that Gladio still exists in some countries. I mean, in Turkey, we now have this Ergenekon affair, which is a very big affair. It's about the Turkish military, which planned to carry out terrorist attacks in public places and then to overthrow the Muslim government of Turkey now in power. Now, the Muslim government now in power said this is unacceptable and put the Turkish generals into jail or in front of court, not into jail, but in front of court. And this is the Ergenekon affair, and it's very closely linked to the Turkish Gladio. So in some countries, we still have the question of secret armies. But generally, on a worldwide perspective, we really have the question of manipulated terrorism, whether we are ready to investigate manipulated terrorism, whether we think it's necessary to look at this.
And what happened with all the arms that were the deposits of arms all around Europe?
Well, the military said they cleared the arms caches and took all the arms and that the arms are now not anymore in private hands of secret soldiers. That's what the military said.
What does the SHAPE said, the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers in Europe?
That is NATO's branch in Brussels, the Supreme Headquarters Allied Power Europe. And they said, we don't comment on it. First, they said there's no secret army. On the second day, they had to correct and say, what we said yesterday is not true. We now have to confirm that some things are true, but we can't tell you more because it's national security. And what they then did in secret is that they had all the ambassadors, the NATO ambassadors from every country. You know, every country has an ambassador to NATO. So Spain has an ambassador to NATO, Germany has an ambassador to NATO. And then the Supreme Headquarters Allied Power Europe had to inform these ambassadors. Because some knew nothing about the secret armies. And then the American general, it's always an American general who is at the top of shape. You know, NATO is always controlled by Americans. And he informed the ambassadors that they were secret armies, but he said they were not linked to terrorism. They were just waiting for the Soviet invasion. So that is actually the storyline that we get. We say, because that is already proven that the secret armies existed and that they were linked to CIA, that they were linked to MI6. That is all proven, and that there were arms caches, that's all proven. So NATO confirmed these things, but they said there's no link to terrorism. And that thing is further research. That is the really delicate and important point, because otherwise we just say, oh, if they say there was no link to research, then that must be true. But before they said there's no secret army, that was not true. So it's better to look more clearly at these things.
And in your book, you have forgotten to talk about the dirty war against anarchism. Why? Because, for example, in Italy, Giuseppe Pinelli was arrested and thrown from a window, accused for being the perpetrator of the Piazza Fontana bombings in 1969. Why you have not mentioned anarchism in your book, just communism?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, basically the fight was against everything on the left. I mean, you would group anarchists to the left, and you would, you know, in some cases also socialists were actually targeted. In Germany, we have lists. In Germany, in the 1950s, part of the secret German stay behind was discovered. It was called Bund Deutscher Jugend Technischer Dienst, BDJ. At that time, it was possible to find so-called lists, proscription lists, we call them. That's lists that had been set up by the secret German army. Those were all former people from the Nazi troops, and they had set up lists of people they wanted to kill in case of an emergency. And there are many people from the socialists on these lists, and when they saw these lists, they were scared. They said, you know, it's 1952, that's just, you know, 7 years of the end of the Second World War, and we are already again in this mess. Why do we have right-wing extremists who want to kill other people and have their list? And what you said about 1969, the Piazza Fontana arrest, that was very strange, because the Italian military and the Italian secret service at the beginning very, very quickly said, that is the political left, anarchists, socialists, communists. All the same, anyway, from the perspective of the secret service, and they you know, arrested this one guy, and he died under very unclear circumstances, and they sort of said, you know, he's guilty. And only later, again here, very important to notice, we need a lot of time to research a terrorist attack. Many years later, we find out that this terrorist attack in Piazza Fontana had been carried out by right-wing extremists.
And do you fear for your life because you're publishing this kind of information that shows that how Gladio had been related to terrorism? Or
no, I don't. I mean, you know, you can say that's naive, you should, but the main thing is, in Switzerland, we never had an academic who was killed because of his research. We never had it in the whole history of Switzerland. There was nobody killed ever here in Switzerland because of his research. It's not the same in other countries, you know. If you do research in Colombia on the paramilitaries, you can die. If you do research in Russia on the war in Chechnya, you can die. In China, you know, if you do research on Tibet and these things, it can be dangerous. It is certainly true that research can be dangerous, but I think that the risks I'm taking are calculable, and I think it's important to think about this research, because if we don't talk about the secret armies, if we don't talk about manipulated terrorism, it is very, very difficult for people who are interested in peaceful coexistence to make any progress, because they will always be paralyzed by fear, and that is the main point. I mean, I'm saying that manipulated terrorism has the idea to create fear in a society. That is the idea. People who die in a terrorist attack, they're not actually the target. They die, but the real target is the people who survive and see this, and who are then scared that they could die, and so they don't say anything, they don't do anything, and, you know, basically accept whatever they are being presented with. You know, the government can say, we need to search your computers. And people would not accept it, but then after a terrorist attack, they say, okay, search my computer. Or they say, we have, you know, to take you into jail for 7 days, you don't have the right to have a lawyer, and that is because there's a big terrorist attack which happened. People, you know, normally would say, no, of course not, that's illegal, you can't do that. But after a terrorist attack, they are scared, and then they sacrifice some of their liberties. And that is not a good idea. It is important to defend democratic rights all the time. Because we've had, you know, too many examples in history of governments who actually abuse their power. I mentioned Chile with Pinochet. I mentioned Stalin in the Soviet Union. You, of course, in Spain, and remember Franco, and in other countries, you know, there's too much abuse of power, too much violence, too much crime, too many lies. And people today communicate over the internet. They communicate in many new ways, and this is gonna have an impact on how they look at things, because they get more stories, not just one story which they read every day in the newspaper, but new stories, and which that will start a reflection process. Now, I'm just one person. There are a million people who work on this. I'm just one.
Anyway, the information that you have in your book is information from newspapers, from books, so it's not confidential or secret information. So for that part, I don't think it's dangerous because all the information is there, but you just have to read it, analyze it, and study it, and put it
yeah.
together. And that's
yeah.
a lot of work that you did in this book, and I thank you for yeah. that. But which documents you would have liked to read and you have been denied the access to?
I would have liked to read the documents of the Allied Clandestine Committee. I talked about this committee many times in this interview already. It is in NATO, that secret unit linked to SHAPE, where the representatives of the different stay-behinds met. You know, sometimes they meet in Brussels, sometimes they meet in Paris, you know, different places that they actually meet. But they always come together and talk about it. Now, we know for sure that the Allied Clandestine Committee existed, because the Belgian Senate, which presented the parliamentary investigation, confirmed that it existed. They had the access to these protocols, and they had access to secret NATO documents. So we know it existed. We also have General Serravalle, who was the general in Italy who commanded the Gladio structures in the 1970s. And he also explains that he was in these ACC meetings, and he talks about them. And we have General Inserilli, who was also an Italian general, who also commanded the Italian Gladio, who talks about the ACC. And the interesting thing about the secret ACC meetings is that you had the Spanish in there, you had the Germans in there, you had the French in there, you had the CIA in there. This is something outside of democratic checks and balances. No parliamentarian knew about it, you know. It was hidden behind the wall, and you couldn't see it. And now I'd like to sort of break this wall and access the documents of the Allied Clandestine Committee, but I asked, you know, I didn't get the documents. The Swiss government, you know, they were asked whether the Swiss P-26, which was the Swiss stay behind, was part of the NATO network. Remember that Switzerland is a neutral country. We shouldn't be part of any NATO network, okay? That is a scandal in Switzerland if that, you know, is confirmed. Now, I think there were links to the NATO networks, and the Swiss government thinks, no, there were no links. We were neutral. That's just the story here. And I don't believe in that story. But anyway, in order to confirm that we were not in the NATO network but had our own independent secret army somehow, the Swiss defense minister said they had asked the Allied Clandestine Committee records whether the Swiss were ever in these meetings. You know, look at the original transcripts. And I said, oh, the Swiss were never in these meetings. I don't know whether that's true or not. I never saw the original documents.
Why do you think that when a person begins to be interested in Gladio operation and the secret armies and looks for information in the internet, all he finds is websites that mix serious information with aliens, UFOs, so a lot of bizarre information, you know, like there's a lot of disinformation on all of this. And in your opinion, what's the reason for this?
I mean, I don't know for sure, but I look at internet sites very critically. You know, some internet sites, really, they mix Gladio and then put aliens next to it. And I say, if I was the Secret Service, I would set up an internet site like this. You know, I would take serious information, very well researched, put it on my homepage, if I was a Secret Service agent, and next to it, I would put aliens, and I would say the world is going to end tomorrow, and I'm going to, you know, just lunatic things, okay? And if you mix these two things, then you actually discredit the information that you put there. Obviously, people don't think that this can be done, but we know, if we look at history, we know that the CIA paid newspapers in the 50s and in the 60s and in the 70s. They paid journalists many thousand euros to publish stories that were in their perspective. That was paid journalists. It was not free and it was not independent, but it was manipulated. Now, that was in the old days when you only had newspapers. Now, for 15 years now, we've had the internet. I mean, I first was on the internet in 1997, so that's 13 years now. And these 13 years, it is very clear that also the secret services start to be aware that this is an important source of information. I'm not saying that every bizarre homepage is manipulated by the secret services. But I think some of them are. I mean, why would you actually do these strange homepages, which everybody walks away with a feeling that it's just
And are you surprised of the lack of democratic control of the secret services around the world?
Yes, I'm really surprised. I mean, we should be more critical about this. I'm saying very clearly that some people who work in the secret services are honest people and do a good job. I don't want to say that everybody in the secret services is a criminal and carries out terrorist attacks on their way home before they kiss their kids goodbye and put them to bed. I mean, I'm not saying this. Some people in the secret services actually have the same training like I do. I am a doctor in history. Okay, I speak different languages, and I like to read about the world. You know, many people in the CIA, I met some people in the CIA, actually have the same background. You know, they love history, they love politics, they love economics, they know about the world, and many people are good people. Okay? I want to put this very clearly. Also in the Spanish Secret Service, some people are very good and honest people. Also in the Swiss Secret Service, okay? But in some cases, the secret services have been involved in criminal operations. And that is not acceptable. And it's just a question of whether we want to know about this or not. But there's a lot of data. There's such a lot of data on this. Gladio is one example. I talked about Allende in Chile in 1973. It's another example. I talked about Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. You know, there's many more examples when you see the secret services of the US, of Great Britain, of Chile, or of Spain, or of Italy were involved in criminal activities. And that is not acceptable. I mean, that's not something very extreme to say. It's just, if you park your car in the wrong place, you get a ticket, okay? That's normal. That's how a system works. And the democracy must control its secret service. It's important. And when the Secret Service is deliberately allowed to carry out criminal activities, then that is not acceptable.
Have you studied the Kosovo Liberation Army and with the links with the CIA?
I know something about the Kosovo Liberation Army. I mean, the interesting thing is that in March 1999, NATO bombs the Kosovo. Now, that was illegal because NATO did not have a mandate from the UN Security Council. And if you don't have a mandate from the UN Security Council, you're not allowed to bomb anybody. It is illegal. The argument put forward at the time was, well, Milosevic is a very evil man, and he maybe was. And secondly, he's killing the people in Kosovo, especially the Albanians. And, you know, some of this was true. But still, you don't have the right to bomb a country. Interestingly enough, the Kosovo Liberation Army was supported by the British and the Americans before the bombing. So you actually made the problem bigger. We have records from the Special Air Service, SAS. These are paramilitaries of the British. And from the Green Berets. These are special forces of the US. That they were in the area and they trained the KLA and made them stronger. By training the KLA and making them stronger, you later increased the problem for Milosevic, because the KLA, together with other Albanians, started the fighting, intensified the fighting in Kosovo. And from the other side, you had the Serbs from the secret forces and the official police forces and the military forces from Milosevic. And these just, you know, engaged in heavy fighting. Still today, you know, they don't trust each other. One group is Muslim. The other group is Orthodox Christians, that's the Serbs and that's the Albanians. And I just look at the conflict and I see the Americans and the British, they at that time supported the Muslims and made them stronger. They increased the problem. And then they said, hey, there's a problem. And then they came with the NATO planes and bombed the Serbs as the air force of the Muslims. It's a strange thing, but it happened. And we need more investigation into the Kosovo conflict, because it seems that the problem was there, but it was intensified deliberately.
And I trimmed about 8 minutes from that video, removing the introduction and hesitations, misspeakings, and so on. But I'll link to the original video from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/692. Similarly, the next interview, I skipped a few minutes. We're going to carry on, not quite where we left off, but very much a similar vein. We return to Sibel Edmonds, FBI whistleblower, being interviewed by James Corbett, she begins by explaining how she came to set up the National Whistleblowers Coalition.
That's how we actually ended up organizing ourselves as National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. What brought us together was I took that commissioner's report, okay, and I said, this is bull. And so many facts have been intentionally omitted, the ones that were given to them, or people were prevented by commission themselves, don't give us this fact. I'm not going to interview you. Time Magazine's Woman of the Year, Colleen Rowley, right, with Mousavi, Zakaria Mousavi case. 2002, right, she became well-known. Well, this was even before 9/11 Commission had started. 9/11 Commission didn't interview Colleen Rowley. They said they were not going to interview her. And as you said, Robert Wright, John Vincent. So what I did was, during my own case, I started meeting and coming across this high level, not like me, I was just a language specialist in the FBI for 6-7 months. These were the people with the FBI for 25 years, 20 years, high level agents, senior agents, whether it's DEA or the FBI. Well, initially there was 10, 11, 12, 13 of us, and before long there were like 70 of us. I said, I'm going to go. I'm going to say there is a press conference. I'm going to throw this in the trash can, and I'm going to tell the media that I went to them. I took them documents. I took them specific file information. I took them name of witnesses, including informants, because they had clearance. And these are the 9/11 Commission investigators. They all had top secret clearance, meaning that was when inside SCIF, I could give them detailed information. I would never right now talk about some informant's name. That would be nefarious, okay? Even if that person is a scumbag, I'm going to cause his death or her death. I'm not going to do that. I did it with 9/11 commissioners because I went inside the SCIF, and the protocol says, look, they have clearance. I can even give them the phone number, the address of the informants and everything. So I did. It's not here. It says defer to the IG. IG investigation was already completely classified. Well, all these agents joined me. They said, we want to do the same thing. So during that press conference, they all came and they stood right next to me and they did the same thing. These are the senior agents, FBI, DEA, Pentagon. And I released the report. People can go and research, and it lists their names, whether it is Tony Schaefer with Able Danger that nobody has an answer to this date, whether it's John Vincent and Agent Wright, whether it's Colleen Rowley. They are all on that list. People who came and said, it's a huge cover-up. All this information has been omitted. And this information includes moles in the FBI from the CIA and the State Department. It includes the terabytes of data being destroyed. And these people would testify under oath. As I said, these are not disgruntled. Agent Vincent, he retired from the FBI. Nobody fired him. So nobody can come and accuse this guy, oh, he's disgruntled because he's saying that, or he's a whack job. Well, he's highly decorated. If he's a whack job and you decorated him highly, there's something really wrong with you. So it's out there. They can go, they can see. And a lot of these cases include not the lack of imagination. That's what they said. Or they couldn't connect the dots. Or there were these walls and the information was not being... Or bureaucratic incompetence bungling. Did we have tons of bureaucratic bungling? Oh, yeah. Did any of these have anything to do with bureaucratic bunglings? Oh, no. Absolutely no. And they would tell you, yes, they were State Department, the CIA. And even with the White House, it gets very interesting because I know the evil Bush we talk about a lot. A lot of these, that includes Agent Wright's case, John Vincent's case, took place in late 1990s, mid-1990s. So you're looking at the Clinton administration and Bush administration. You're looking at a Democrat and you're looking at a Republican. So it's not partisan. It doesn't go only to two evils, Cheney and Bush. You know, and this is very important to talk about briefly here. When I'm talking about this Gladio, Plan B, these cases, Clinton, Bush administration, one of the biggest reasons I believe a lot of people don't get it and don't want to get it, and this is in the United States, with most of our foreign viewers, That doesn't seem to be the case as much, but especially with the United States, is we are conditioned to look at things as very classic black hat guys and the guys in white hats, okay? Now, you get these guys in black hats versus other guys in black hats, it just doesn't go through. It's just this automatic wall comes up, and they're like, oh, well, because what Russians are doing is really bad, and here's what Israel is doing in this case really bad, and here's U.S., here are these, the State Department, Democrats, Republicans, Clinton, Bush. No, that doesn't fit our paradigm, because we have to say PNAC, Bush and Cheney versus the good Democrats, and they were the ones that did it. Now, that's simple. That's easy. I can go for that. I can really put my support behind that, okay? Including like what you're talking about, and this is Common Cause, the NGO that was set up here, you know, the website during Bush administration that was Soros funded. It becomes very easy, and it's like, give me the black hat guys and tell me these are the white, and I can follow you. If you come, whether you're Sibel Edmonds or if you're Colleen Rowley, and you say, yeah, but it involved this administration, Democrats and Republicans, okay, allies and non-allies, then I'm going to say it's crazy. Then I'm going to say it doesn't make sense to me. And it's always been this way. And you have covered in your program these episodes on education. It is framed that way from the beginning for us. I mean, even with the test taking. One quick example would be, okay, Watergate incident and what happened with Nixon. Okay, there is this classic narrative. And we have some good guys. We have guys that we believe they had white hats. I mean, Bob Woodward was there, Washington Post, you know. They were fantastic. They carried a lot of this. It makes it very sexy. It makes it very Hollywoodish. Imagine a Hollywood movie when you don't have guys with white hats. They're all black hat guys. So you want to give a test. This is the classic you give them. And there's one answer. Because with those tests and multiple options tests, they can't say this, however. You can't put a however or but. You can't start bringing in some critical thinking elements and say, all right, now it's interesting because look at Washington Post before Watergate and long after Watergate. Why there was such an aberration there? What has really Bob Woodward done? He's been the mouthpiece of White Houses from Bush to Obama. And he has millions of dollars. I went to his house in Georgetown. He was one of the first reporters I got introduced to during my case, before even my case came out, okay? His kids are going to private schools. He is the system. He's the CIA's darling. And Washington Post, Iran-Contra, what did they do? If it was the Washington Post and reporters, it happened during this time with Watergate. It didn't happen before. It didn't happen after. You see, because the classic way is you get people like Gary Webb and Iran-Contra. If you're a good reporter, you do your job. That's what happens to you. Not become a multimillionaire scumbag Bob Woodward, okay? Looking at it this way, from this angle, that makes you think and say, really, let's look at Watergate. And based on some of the documents that have been already public, based on some people who have already talked, is it what they tell us it was about? Was it true that there were some elements that they wanted to see Nixon gone? Okay.
They really wanted to get caught at any rate. I think that much is apparent from or someone in that operation wanted to get caught at some point. And absolutely, they were handed that story on a golden platter. Why don't we get to some of the questions and comments that came in from our last conversation? Because we've had a lot of feedback from people about it, and I want to address some of these people's questions and concerns. For example, we had from someone called Errol E. He wrote in to take issue with some of the things that we brought up in the last conversation, including his contention that the idea to implement the Islamist cults as actors of Gladio did not come up after the Susurluk scandal, but was long prepared beforehand. And I was wondering if you could address that idea. Is there something to the fact that this was something that had already been in existence before Susurluk? And if so, then what was really the changing incident there? What really took place?
Of course. I mean, first you can start with 1980s and Afghanistan, okay, with Mujahideens and our partnership with Al-Qaeda, not Al-Qaeda, because it's such a thing, Al-Qaeda with Mujahideen and Bin Laden back then. Then you're looking at all the religious cults, even in Iran, Okay, that's another thing, and that is for another program. People, they say, okay, Iran, Islamic Revolution, but it's so much more into, I was there, my father was right in the thick of it, okay? It's not the story presented here. First of all, there was no Islamic Revolution. The initial revolution in Iran was actually carried out, organized mainly by social democrats and the leftists, the Hezbollah. But I'm not going to get into that. Did we have been doing that before us, the United Kingdom, the Brits have been doing this. This has been a classic approach using, and especially by the British Empire, using religion. So that part of it is not new. And even some of these elements early on in 1990s, sure, but they were not prioritized and they did not become NATO's Gladio's adopted new plan. That is, were they being used by the CIA? Yes. Were they being used by the British intelligence agencies? Absolutely. But it was not prior. And again, we had Gladio, and this is specifically Gladio, going through the military and ultra-nationalist faction. It was after Susurluk when NATO, Gladio, adapted. Because before that, they were being implemented, but not by NATO. And it was not part of Gladio's operation. It wasn't. Absolutely, it wasn't. That became after Susurluk incident.
We have a question in from John S., and he writes, when Dickerson and Grossman were yanked home out of Turkey following Susurluk, it may seem very obviously linked to that scandal, and I'm sure it totally is, but how do we know, or do we know? Again, how much is reasonable conjecture and logical conclusion, and how much is something more than that? Information, statements, documents, links to Gladio, etc.
Sure, and again, part of this question is caused by, partly by the fact of all the secrecy and classification. That's one. But then for people not knowing the whole picture because they haven't looked at this case, they haven't looked at this book, because you start with Grossman and with Dickerson. However, later, they, at least Grossman, was part of the FBI's investigations. And even though he was first number three guy in the State Department and end up being number two guys, his job actually was with NATO and these operations in Central Asia and Caucasus, and they don't know that. The other thing that this question, the person who asked the questions is disregarding is with Dickerson, so he was sent to NATO, then to the United States. When my case came out, when he was under investigations, when the court case was still proceeding, my court case, and the Congress was at the beginning, initial stage of his investigations, even though the judge had banned him, Dickerson got in the plane and he said he has a new job, he's going to NATO. So he was sent to NATO Brussels. He escaped. Okay, while under investigations, then this was completely supported by the Pentagon's Gladio Division. And then he went, and this would be end of August, early September 2002. Where did he end up? Brussels. Where did he end up? NATO Brussels. Not only that, one of the things, again, if they have read my books, they wouldn't even have this question. First thing that happened before the FBI was stopped and I became the target of retaliation, there was a damage assessment on the espionage to see how much information, intelligence we have lost due to the spies in the FBI, okay? How much documents and informants, safety, etc. Well, the top four targets of the FBI within this period, even though they still had more official time left from their official position overseas, they were removed and they were sent not to Turkey, they were sent to NATO. I would ask them to look at this very important guy, for example, in a Turkish consulate in Chicago, and Chicago consul, where did he end up? Again, he had more time left in his term. However, he was given a very high-level position in NATO in Brussels. So you're looking at criminal top targets who ended up in NATO, including Dickerson's. So that is not to take one or two or three incidents and say, these people are there. That's one. And the second thing is FBI's operations counterintelligence has already established that. I didn't call it Plan B, okay? The file that has to do with Grey Wolves turned into Gladio Plan B operations. And this was the reason these investigations, operations had to be stopped by the State Department and Pentagon. And this was why they didn't want any of these proceed in courts, because They didn't want anyone to know that this was the operation they were carrying it out, including their operations together with bin Laden and the Mujahideen, part of the NATO operation.
We have a question from Emery. How does Sibel consider the Ergenekon trials in light of Gladio? What does she make of the claim that it is a U.S.-backed operation to replace the secular nationalist establishment with a more pliant Islamic capitalist establishment using the Gulen movement?
100%, I believe, and anyone who knows and who understands and who is analyzing this objectively would tell you, Ergenekon is completely 100% U.S. plan, U.S. backed plan. Look, I will give a very quick example. In 1997, okay, the same administration, Turkish regime, the Turkish government, AKP government, but these are all Gulen's guys, okay, Erdogan and Gul, the Islamic, current Islamic people. They won the election, okay? And in 1997, their party won the majority, both popular and everything, right? However, this was not exactly during the time the United States had switched from the military secularists. So the military in Turkey said, too bad, they have the majority of votes, but we're not going to let them get into power. So you know what they did, right? The Turkish military shut down AKP. They took Erdogan. They put him in jail. They said, vote doesn't matter. I mean, if you vote and it's not our guy who gets the majority, we'll put them in court. The military in Turkey can never, ever, ever do anything. They can't even pee without the permission from the United States, okay? This is no different than the military in Egypt under Mubarak. The military regimes we install, they are not answerable to the presidents or the kings that we have installed. They are answerable to the United States. As simple as that. Same thing with the Iran revolution, and I'm not going to call it Islamic revolution. Shah's military, they all put their guns down, and I hate the Shah. He tortured my father, okay? Who told them to put down their guns? Suddenly, boom, they put their, and they told Shah he was on his own. He escaped, and before he died, Shah said, it was the United States' wish. They said to the military, don't support or protect him. So when the United States believe you're the fair game and it's over, babe. Now, in this case, the military in 1997, they said you're not allowed with the green lights from the United States. What changed? 5 years later, the same party, the same man gets the same number of votes, and lo and behold, nobody puts them in jail. They get into power. And starting within the first 2-3 years, they start taking the top, not top military guys. Military got divided. Those who are willing to go along with the U.S. NATO Operation Plan B, including this administration, and the segment that was still ultra-nationalist and secularist, and the United States gave the green light saying, go after them. Without the United States giving the green light, say, yes, you can do it, no way you would see that. And again, what kind of aberration are we talking about? Between 1997 and 2002, the military got enlightened. And we had the real democracy. This time, the ones who got the majority, in fact, came into power. That the difference 5 years make, you know, makes a change. It's very disappointing because, as I said, in the United States, people are so conditioned to frame their minds around this white hat, black hat, and things are set up this way. And when things are outside that paradigm, they just cannot absorb it. And one of the unfortunate things and disheartening things that I have observed with some of the comments is destroying the 9/11 truth movement. There are people who are eating each other within the movement. It's like, it's LIHOP, it's my hop. If it's LIHOP, it can't be my hop. Well, if it's my hop, hop hop. And they get into some semantics and they get into some, and they are self-destroying. I don't know how much of it is caused by planted elements to have this division. I don't know how much of it is the natural course of, I think it's evolving in some ways, but I am attributing a lot of this with this, I guess, decades of systemic conditioning for people to say, this is how you view the world, this is how you view the things, this is how you answer buts and howevers, or this and also. We want to get rid of these. The answer is either A, B, C, D. You know, LIHOP, MIHOP, no, nothing, Israel. And they need to first put that away. Open it up. Take in the entire picture. Critically think about it. And if they want to refuse certain theory or certain explanation, that's fine. But it's very disheartening. And I'm hoping that we will get more and more people with open minds watching this thing and thinking, and first get rid of all the old conditionings. And I know it's hard to do, but it's very disheartening, especially for some of the journalists and people who've been trying very hard. I know many whistleblowers have given up because they got disgusted of being attacked and their major revelations being completely obscured by some stupid, excuse my language, really idiotic semantics and details. So again, I encourage people to put everything aside, absorb, and do your own research, because there's plenty out there to see.
Well, amen to that. And doing one's own research is the best way to understand something. As an unwelcome guest listener, you're, I think, extremely well informed about some of the shortcomings of the official narrative. But what about those close to you? I recommend also informing those people who trust your opinion, those people who are interested in what you're thinking about, encouraging them also to question the official narrative. This is about the time I put in a plug for Wikispooks, which is an international collaborative tool to examine the official narrative, to look at deep political structures and events, to look closely at the stories offered by the commercially controlled media. How many of them stand up to close scrutiny? Which aspects of them make sense? Which aspects of them are better explained by alternative theories, such as false flag terrorism? Unlike a lot of alternative narrative websites, this is not read-only, so it's not a matter of just consuming. I use it as a way of keeping track of my own thoughts, contributing if I hear something particularly remarkable, which I think is well-sourced, credible, I'll put it on the website. And thanks to all the unwelcome guest listeners who have taken part in Wikispooks. We've been trying to piece together an article on Operation Gladio B, as well as improving the Operation Gladio article. As we've examined before on the show, if the commercially controlled media doesn't report on a topic, then Wikipedia has a policy to say, well, it's not notable if it's not on TV or in newspapers. That makes it all too easy for the powers that should not be to keep certain topics, certain opinions, out of the public arena. Well, if you have material that you think people should know about, then contributing it to Wikispooks is a good way to subject it to peer review and to bring it to a wider audience. Now, I hadn't even heard of the Agenicon cases until I was researching this episode. Sibel Edmonds suggests this is a US establishment-friendly elite who have been placed in power, trying to remove the old guard to get rid of the old Turkish generals. Now, while they may well have been very corrupt, Agenicon is portrayed as a series of corruption trials. Now, I was hampered in my own research by the language barrier. As an English-only radio station, like with the Susuluk incident, there wasn't a lot of material available about the Agenicon cases. And from that limited selection, this is what I've chosen to give us, I hope, a reasonable overview of what's going on. This is from March 2014 from the multilingual news channel Euronews.com.
It's a case that's brought Turkey's military to heel and sown the seeds for the civilian government to assert more control. The jailing of a former military chief and other senior figures in the so-called Agenicon case will have deep and long-lasting repercussions. Ex-generals, politicians and journalists were all thrown in the dock, 275 people in all, accused of being involved in a plot to topple the Islamic-orientated government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. More than a dozen of them received a life sentence, including former Chief of Defence Staff, General Ilkka Bashbo, the most prominent defendant. Well-known journalist and opposition member Mustafa Balbay was jailed for 35 years. According to prosecutors, a network of secular nationalists, codenamed Genocon, planned high-profile attacks aimed at causing chaos in Turkey and triggering a military coup. Critics say the charges were trumped up and aimed at stifling opposition. Erdogan denied interfering in the legal system. The government says it respects the court's decisions. It's a fact that no one has any right to commit a crime, he says. The court gave the best decision according to its deliberations. We'll see what happens with the subsequent appeals. The trial has sparked protests. Police blocked hundreds of demonstrators from reaching the criminal court west of Istanbul. There were clashes, stones were thrown, police responded with tear gas and water cannon. The secularist military staged three coups between 1960 and 1980. It cleared the first Islamist-led government out of office in 1997. The five-year trial did initially have the backing of the Turkish public, who hoped it would hold secularists to account. But that support waned as people increasingly took the view that it was an effort to clean up political opponents. Makar Esayan, a journalist with a Taraf newspaper in Istanbul, has been closely watching the Ergenekon case. He's discussed the repercussions of the landmark trial with Euronews correspondent Bora Bayraktar.
What does the Ergenekon case mean for Turkey? What is it all about?
It's not only a trial about a military coup attempt, it's also a trial of all the preliminary activities, killings and provoking incidents, to convince the people that a coup is actually necessary. From this point of view, it's the first of its kind in Turkey. And politically, it's a turning point and a milestone. Because of this, it's also triggered many debates. At the beginning, it was discussed with the public, and we can say that the Turkish public was divided in two because of this. This was normal. It was a step to rule of law from the law of the privileged people. Strong generals, businessmen, journalists, well-known people, and military people, politicians who were considered untouchable, they all face justice in this case. And now they've all been punished. It's the first time in Turkish history.
Because of the political nature of this case, some people have looked at it and they see it as an attempt to take revenge. I just wonder to what extent you agree with that.
I would not agree with that. I can't. The real answer to your question is this. With this case, together with the Sledgehammer case, Turkey is changing the mind of the state. When we talk about Ergenekon, we're not talking about people or a narrow gang who gather in secret underground offices and organize crimes. Ergenekon is what we called Gladio in the 50s, or counter-guerrilla, or JITEM Under different names, it continued to survive. If you put this in a certain period of time, you can't understand it. Ergenekon for me starts in 1913 with the attack of the Committee of the Union and Progress against Ottoman liberals. It includes assassinations and coups, and it's the structure of the state. I mean, Ergenekon is not an organization, but it was the state itself. It's a way of ruling the state, which includes moving from the routine, eliminating others by using the force of the state, executing the ministers and the prime minister, as they did.
No, I won't tell you whether the generals are the good guys or whether it's the people putting them in prison. You heard Sibel Edmonds. Now, I don't think Turkey, by the way, is very different from other nation states. Possibly the Susurluk incident has raised the role of the deep state to a higher level in people's minds, but then the nations of Western Europe had Gladio. If you're a Western European taxpayer, you're funding NATO, an organization which set up and funds a gang of false flag terrorists. I'm not aiming to depress you, but then there it is. So what to do about this? Well, as I've done these deep politics shows, I've become more and more convinced that if we accept money as a given, we're never going to be free of this. There's always that temptation to put your fingers in the till. Suddenly, if you can walk away with a brown envelope, you're commanding the loyalty of tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of people because of this unaccountable power that's called money. And if we say, yes, this is an important thing, I want it, then we are submitting to that system. We are effectively helping to support terrorism the way that we are if we pay our taxes to a government that then bombs us. If that strikes you, as Daniela Ganser says, as unacceptable, then I would suggest withdrawal from the money system. If you think it's practically impossible for you, at least declare it as an aim. Tell your friends, this is what I believe and this is why. Debate the matter and spread the idea. Will this mean that the planet stops spinning in its orbit? I think not. It will mean a change to the established social order, the existing power structures. As Philip K. Dick said, reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. I think if we stop believing in money, it would go away. There might be one or two people wandering around saying, guys, we've got to have money, keep believing in money, do what I say, I'm a rich person. But then if they didn't have a paid army of mercenaries to enforce their will, these people could be happily ignored. It's this unaccountable power over relationship, which is money, which is also central to capitalism and the command hierarchy, that I think gets an easy ride. People criticize a lot of other aspects of capitalism, and I think if they're not criticizing money and the way it works, then it's not a radical enough analysis. If you'd like to debate the matter, you're welcome to do so. We have a discussion page on this show's website, or you could email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. If you'd like to download this or any previous episodes, you can do so from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, and lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I was encouraged to see that the episode 649 I did on ending money is now our most popular episode with over 10,000 views. If you like the idea of stepping away from money, then do get in touch. And if you'd like to help document the deep state, you can do so at wikispooks.org.